Somebody ought to celebrate the awesome God.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Coming this Monday, June 15th at 11 p.m. on the Bedtime Radio Show for Grown-Ups, Gremlin Time.
My dear Carson, as you read this manuscript, I will be dead. No one is to blame. My death was as certain as all the other strange events I foresaw.
An adaptation of the suspense story by Cornell Woolrich.
Will doubt this story
and dismiss it as a series of contrived events and coincidences.
Edward G. Robinson stars.
But you, Carson, and some of the others will know that there are things on Earth still hidden from us. Still secret and unfathomable.
In the Night Has a Thousand Eyes. This Monday night, 11 p.m., on the Bedtime Radio Show for Grown-Ups, Gremlin Time.
I suppose most men can look back and see the exact point where destiny touched them.
Right here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to An Islamic Point of View, a production of the Muslim Community Center of Portland and this station. MCCP extends sincere condolences and prayers to the families and friends of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and the many others who have been brutally murdered by law enforcement and their surrogates in this country. MCCP recognizes that black people on this land have suffered immensely from slavery, oppression, murder, and discrimination for over 400 years. Black Americans have always had a particularly difficult time with law enforcement, and this painful history has resulted in the intergenerational trauma, pain, and fear of so many in our communities. We acknowledge this shameful history and ongoing oppression, and we take a clear stand against anti-blackness and racism in all its forms against anyone. It is our duty as Muslims to help the oppressed through our prayers, aid, solidarity, and willingness to listen and learn. It is also our responsibility to stop oppression, and perhaps the most lasting way to do this is to shatter the mentalities that are breeding grounds for white supremacy, capitalist excess, misogyny, and other oppressive ideas and structures. Today, we have a special interview from Dr. Bilal Ware, entitled The Key Lessons from the History of Islam in West Africa.
This is a vast topic and one that has been ignored for a very long time. So it's not a thing that I could fully do justice to in any way in a brief interview as this. So I'm just going to touch on a couple of key, themes that I think, provide lessons, like, trying to provide maximum benefit in a short amount of time. So I'll reduce it to three kind of key lessons that we can draw from the West African Islamic tradition. Keeping in mind, first and foremost, that the West African Islamic tradition is the origin of the American Muslim community, because enslaved Africans were brought to this country before this country was this country. Before there's a United States of America, there are Muslims that are praying on plantations in South Carolina, and there are Muslims that are praying in Virginia, and there are Muslims that are praying in New York City before, when it's under Dutch control. So Islam gets implanted here in what eventually becomes the United States of America, before, the Declaration of Independence and all that. So this is really about an investigation of not what we can learn from a different tradition, but what we can learn by looking back to the origins of our own tradition. Okay, that's the first thing. So then what are the kind of three principal lessons that we can draw from that? And I'll reduce it to just three words in order to keep things simple. Peace, knowledge, and benefit. Okay, now what do I mean by those? I'll give a short definition and then I'll expand with some historical examples. So peace, giving reference to two things primarily. First, that the Islamic tradition in West Africa spreads almost exclusively through nonviolent means. Okay, so West African countries that are today 95, 98, 99% Muslim were never subject to the Arab conquest that led to the establishment of Islam in other parts of the Muslim world. Muslims in sub-Saharan West Africa adopted Islam voluntarily, and there's a lot of wisdom that can be drawn from how they were able to successfully spread Islam peacefully. Because that's, if we're gonna spread Islam in this country, that's how we gonna do it, okay? The second part of the piece is that the focus on peace was part of a broader focus on downplaying explicitly political and worldly aspirations amongst learned scholars. Leave the world to the worldly. Focus on spiritual and social development amongst the children of Adam, and you will build a sound society from the bottom up by forming one solid human brick at a time. Rather than trying to capture power from the top down, build society from the bottom up. So peace, and I'll come back to historical examples. Knowledge, focus on a deep commitment to learning and scholarship, okay? In other words, Islam not as being about identity, I'm a Muslim. What does that mean? It means, learning, pursuing knowledge of God. Pursuing knowledge of his messenger, alayhi salatu wasalam. That's the model. So not focused on identity, not even focused in a narrow way on piety. Piety is of course important, but the people of guidance in this religion have been referred to in the Quran as the ulama, the knowledgeable. So being pious isn't enough. you've got to pursue knowledge. And that has particular lessons for our communities, particularly I think in the African American Muslim community. As a kid, small child growing up in D.C. in the late 1970s, early 1980s, if you had your face in a book, somebody would accuse you of acting white. And we need to be reminded that there were jet black West African scholars reading and writing books in the Arabic language, reading and writing books in African languages using the Arabic script 1,000 years ago. And they built their communities and centered their social lives around the pursuit of knowledge. So that is in no way a value or a set of practices that's alien to our community. Finally, benefit. And then these are just the glosses. We'll give it some examples. Benefit, that the main part of how that peaceful spread of Islam took place was that there was less of a focus on overt proselytizing, attempting to convince people of the truth of your religion, than there was an attempt to focus on providing benefit to the children of Adam, Muslim and non-Muslim alike. There's a hadith where the Prophet says that the hearts of the children of Adam naturally incline to those who provide benefit for them. If you want to have Islam impact this society, either through conversion or just through informing the ethical values of the society itself, through Islamic examples, and both things are good from a Muslim standpoint, then the best way to do that is to focus on providing benefit to people rather than trying to convince them that you're right and they're wrong. Okay, now, practical historical examples. The military conquest, peace first, the military conquest didn't reach sub-Saharan Africa for a number of reasons. First and foremost, when the Muslims tried to come down the Nile, they were defeated by a Nubian army in 652 CE that had a corps of archers that were described in contemporary Muslim sources as capable of putting an arrow in your eye from 300 paces away. You know, so if you see, Steph Curry, draining jump shots, know that manual dexterity, didn't start when when Africans came here. So this led to, military prowess in an African context, and the Muslims were unable to invade sub-Saharan Africa. They were stopped. So then a different course of action and different set of relationships emerged because of that. Merchants then spread Islam first, but merchants are there on business. They're not there to teach people religion, but they open the first trade routes that then allow scholars to come behind. But not even that many scholars initially make that move. What's decisive, especially in West Africa, is that after the first Muslims come a few scholars follow them, down trans-Saharan trading trails, some indigenous West Africans themselves not only convert to Islam, but take it as their vocation to teach the Quran and to spread Islam and Islamic knowledge specifically within their own societies. So it's the emergence of an indigenous West African clerical class, a class that focuses on religious knowledge, that ends up transmitting Islam in all the different directions throughout West Africa. Yeah, sure. So in the very earliest days, the earliest traditions that you can document are two towns that are now in the modern Republic of Mali. They were at the time within the bounds of the Empire of Ghana, which was the right there with China, the wealthiest and most powerful kind of political unit in the world at the time. But the two towns were called Kabara and Jaga. So Kabara was a place that produced a bunch of really erudite scholars, from the period of about 900 or 1000 CE until the 15 or 1600s, and not so many since. But Jaga, which is the point of origin for probably the oldest living tradition of scholarship today in West Africa, the Jahanke tradition, the name comes from Jaga, that was a teaching tradition that was established in the same period and is still alive today, more than 1,000 years old. And there's Jahanke clerical families with names like Drame, Jane, Sise, Ture, and others in almost every West African country right down to the present. And they, in turn, members of other West African ethnic groups imitated their model and began specializing in Islamic knowledge within their own communities, because they learned Quran from these people and replicated the model in their own society. So Islam spread in these ways. So this happens, you know, in Senegal. It happens in really all over, you know, the all over West Africa. And this, you know, ends up being the thing that really starts to implant Islam in West African society as early as 1,000 years ago. You know, the way that I often like to say this is that so the Quran was taught on these wooden boards, which was actually one of the first mediums that was used to write the Quran in the early days of Islam. And it's still used in West Africa today, even though it's almost been abandoned everywhere else in the Muslim world. So it was the jihad of the wooden board, not the jihad of the sword, that spread Islam in West Africa. So the jihad of teaching people literacy skills and the Quranic text that did a lot of the work. But it was tied, and I just take things just, you know, so you see that, you know, that element of knowledge. It was also tied to providing benefit, because the basic Jahanke ethic, we'll focus on the Jahanke specifically, was actually to avoid overt proselytizing. They did not aggressively try to convince people of Islam. Their goal, explicitly stated, was to provide a model. And so instead, they would do things like, you know, cook large amounts of food on Friday, give them away as alms. And this produces a spiritual benefit for the one who gives the alms, but it also provides a material benefit for people who need, you know, healthy food and who might be hungry that day. And if the hearts of the children of Adam naturally incline to those who provide benefit, then their hearts are going to start to incline to people who provide this kind of benefit. One of the things that they often specialized in was actually using herbal healing technologies as well. So these teaching families were also often healing families. So this is also another way, you know, that they were seeking to provide benefit. So this peaceful spread of Islam was related to those other two dimensions, the knowledge dimension and the benefit dimension. But that peaceful spread was predicated on, especially in the Jahanke case, but also with a bunch of other clerical groups in West Africa, and I'll mention a few of them. It was based on an explicit avoidance of political authority. Scholars should not try to become kings, because the basic role of the scholar in the West African, and one could say indeed the Islamic conception of the relationship between political and religious authority, the basic role of the scholar is to provide an independent, autonomous, ethical and religious critique of those who exercise power. So they separate church and state to protect the independence of the church, not to protect the state. See, in the West, we separate church and state to protect the state from the church. They did it to protect the church from the state, to keep it from being corrupted by the natural tendency in the human being to provide interpretations of Islamic law and Islamic understandings that would be favorable to political authorities, so that they would ultimately, you know, be currying favor with rulers, or even trying to become rulers themselves. And in the cases that the few cases where they did try to become rulers themselves, the results were often, you know, bad, because who is going to provide an independent critique of the state when the scholars have become the state? So you end up with bad religion and bad politics at the same time. And this was not just in the Jahanke tradition, and within the tradition of the Mouridiyya in Senegal. There's a famous story about the founder of the Mouridiyya, Ahmadou Bamba Mbake. He's invited by the most powerful ruler in his part of the world in the late 19th century, Kadamo Kajor, to come and serve as his chief judge. And Bamba, as a young man, you know, got to observe some of the fundamental injustices that could be, you know, tied to that. Actually, many of them had to do with justifications for enslaving people, and he distanced himself from this because it was something that he found revolting. In fact, there was once when a person came to try to give him a gift of a slave because of his piety, and he said, "You own him?" And the man said, "Yes." And he said in Wolof, he said, "Soko mo me yamu mo ndahmak mo nyoboko borom," which means, "If you own him, then you own me, because he and I have the same master." So Bamba was reticent to get involved in any kind of political game plan that might cause him to compromise his ethics. But he was very well known as a scholar, you know, had a huge reputation. So they kept insisting that making this offer for him to come and serve as the chief judge. Finally, he had had enough. He sent a letter to the Damo. Now the Damo doesn't read Arabic to himself. You know, he has his court scribes, you know, read it to him. So the scribe opens it, the letter, and he starts to read it, and he says, you know, "King, I can't read this letter." He's like, "You know, read the letter. What's wrong with you?" He said, I can't read it. It's too offensive. I'm not gonna read the letter." He said, "Read the letter." He said, "I'm not gonna read it. It's hurtful to me." He said, "Read the letter." He said, he uses a maxim from Muhammad ibn Maslama, one of the early scholars of Islam, that compares the cleric who curries favor at the court of a king to a fly feeding on a pile of feces. And the king says, "I don't know what you're so upset about. He's comparing you to a fly. He's calling me a pile of..." So the point was that by the appropriate relationship between the religious and temporal authority, this comes up in the example from the Maliki juridical school, the founder of the Maliki school, Malik ibn Anas, was once called by the caliph at the time, Harun al-Rashid, who was, al-Rashid means the rightly guided, but he had a reputation for being not all that rightly guided. So he gets this invitation, he responds, he says that, "I would be ashamed to have the angels of the right and the left recording the tracks of my steps on the way to the door of a sultan in a matter of the dunya. I would be ashamed to be recorded walking to the court of a king in a worldly matter." So the basic idea is that the appropriate role is that political authorities should go visit scholars, because that's beneficial. But when scholars go to the king, it means that they want something in this world. And you should watch out. There's a story that goes with that. Is that one of the pious has a dream where he sees one of the scholars burning in the fires of hell, and he sees one of the kings enjoying the gardens of paradise, and he is puzzled at this because it's contrary to the expectations of the people. And then a voice comes and says, the king is in the garden for being close to the scholars, and the scholar is in the fire for being close to kings. So this wasn't just a kind of thoughtless disengagement from the political sphere. It was an ethical disengagement from the political sphere. It wasn't just in the cases like amongst the Jahanke or within the Muridiya tradition where there's pronounced doctrines of nonviolence. It wasn't just the kind of unthinking nonviolence, like, "Oh, violence is bad." No, there's certain kinds of violence that you know, when people, you know, attack your family, you have a right to defend yourself. We all agree that states sometimes have to exercise violence in order to, you know, to protect people. It's not that kind of you know, where you say, "Oh, you know, all violence is bad." No, but rather it was an ethical and spiritual value that was attached to never needlessly or carelessly spilling the blood of the children of Adam, because nothing is more precious in the sight of God. There's another scholar called Cheno Bokar Salif Tal, who says that the only jihad that we know is the jihad against the ego, the jihad in nafs. He says, as for the other one, he said it's waged by people who loudly proclaim to love God, but they love him badly because they destroy the most precious of his creation. So instead of, you know, harming the children of Adam, provide benefits to the children of Adam. Instead of proclaiming your Muslim identity and standing on high looking down at other folks, teach and learn knowledge. You know, make yourself knowledgeable, make yourself beneficial. People will want what you have. You won't have to tell them about it. You won't have to persuade them. They'll be persuaded by your, example. You know, because people don't really, a certain amount of impact can be had by listening to what people say, but human beings are more practical than that. We watch what people do, and when you see, somebody, who behaves in a way that's beautiful, you aspire towards that, and you want whatever they have that allows them to do it. Now, when you stand from a position of, I'm a Muslim, I'm better, my identity is superior to yours, people can smell pride at distance, and it's revolting. They will turn and run in the other direction. They don't want nothing of what you got. But when you cultivate humility, when you serve the weak and the poor and the needy, then they get interested. There's also another, benefit in that, which is that they always started with the weak and the poor and the needy, because that was also why it was such a strong critique against the people who went running to kings. Because, the Quran teaches that the followers of all of the prophets, upon them all peace, always had their impact amongst the poorest and the meekest members of society, because they had nothing to lose. One of the biggest difficulties in getting people getting people interested in Islam if they're non-Muslim, or getting people to make spiritual progress if they already are Muslim, is getting people to give up attachment to the dunya, give up attachment to worldly things. Listen, poor folks have had the world make that decision for them. They've already given up one of the four principal enemies of man. Ghazali identifies them, and Ahmed Ubamba, the scholar I just mentioned earlier, he reduces them to a mnemonic device to help you understand. They're the nafs, the shaitan, the hawa, the dunya. Na-sha-ha-du, we bear witness. So the lower soul, the devil, the passions, and the world. And the world has already been, taken away from poor people. They don't have nothing to lose, so it's easier to reach them. Start by feeding the poor. Do that rather than, preach. So knowledge, benefit, peace, scholarship, service, and a focus on the social rather than the political. And there are many, many other examples that I can get to, far too many, for an interview this short. And there's all kinds of wonderful scholarship that emerges from this tradition. Because of the trauma of slavery, many, as I said at the beginning, many of these West African scholars and West African Muslims end up being brought, to these very shores, and they're the first ones to implant Islam here. There's many elements to this story, and I discuss a number of them in a book that called the Walking Quran: Islamic Education, Embodied Knowledge, and History in West Africa. So, inshallah, this brief, exchange about some of the key elements of that Islamic West African tradition that are most applicable in our society here today will invite people to reflection, will invite people to reflect on Islamic ethical principles and models, but also on history, and also specifically on West African history and the things that can be gained from it. And inshallah, that will be a thing that will provide both knowledge and benefit and hopefully lead to increasing peace.
You have been listening to An Islamic Point of View here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. You can listen to An Islamic Point of View every Sunday at 8 a.m. here on KBOO. To support this program, go to kboo.fm or mccpdx.org. Today's special interview was by Dr. Bilal Ware and entitled Key Lessons from the History of Islam in West Africa. Thank you for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.
Is your organization planning a virtual event? Looking